And we'd love to just welcome everyone to tonight's Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics relating to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic is Resources for the Future's Carbon Pricing Calculator Training. We're going to join Mark Halfstead, fellow and director of the Carbon Pricing Initiative at Resources for the Future, along with CCL's research coordinator, Jerry Hinkle, for a training that will preview some of the main findings from the recent carbon pricing economic and energy model used by Resources for the Future and their own calculator to really evaluate current carbon pricing bills, including the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. So with that, I'll actually pass it to you, Jerry, to introduce our esteemed guest, and thank you all again for taking the time to join us tonight.
Thanks, Brett. It's really my pleasure to introduce Mark Halfstead. So he is a fellow and the director of the Carbon Pricing Initiative at Resources for the Future. He's a leading researcher on the evaluation and design of climate and energy policies. So he built the model with Larry Golder of Stanford University, which is used to generate the results used in the calculator that we're about to see. And he co-authored the book, Confronting the Climate Challenge, U.S. Policy Options, which both evaluates the environmental and economic impacts of carbon taxes generally, and it really kind of serves to document the model's methods and results. He's also a leading expert on the employment impacts of carbon pricing. And finally, Mark has a PhD in economics from Stanford University. So I want to go over the learning goals tonight. The first thing is to understand how to use this GHE3 carbon pricing calculator. The second is to discover more about the Resources for the Future's model that underlies the results in the calculator. And finally, we want to review the key elements of carbon tax policies in the carbon pricing calculator. That's it. I will hand it over to Mark. Take it away.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm always happy to talk about our work at Resource for the Future. Jerry did a great job of introducing me, so I don't think I need to say anything else there about myself. So thank you, Jerry. Appreciate it. But let me just say something about RFF and generally for those who aren't super familiar with Resource for the Future. So RFF's mission is to improve environmental, energy, and natural resource decisions through impartial economic research and policy engagement. We're committed to being the most widely trusted source of research insights and policy solutions leading to a healthy environment and a thriving economy. In our carbon pricing initiative, our goal is to provide rigorous analysis and a nonpartisan and objective voice to leaders to help them better understand the impacts of various carbon pricing policies. We do not lobby or take any institutional positions on any policy, whether that's legislative, executive, or judicial. So that's kind of where we are as an organization. So also, I should mention that the carbon pricing calculator is rff.org/CPC. So it's pretty easy to find. So today I'm happy to talk about the RFF carbon pricing calculator, which we introduced about 3 weeks ago online. And this is built off of, we have previously had a carbon tax calculator, and I think this is a big improvement on what we had before. And so I'm happy to share and talk about it. Before I get into kind of using the calculator, which we'll go through here. I want to just talk just through a few of these kind of bullet points on the side here. So the E3 model, and as Jerry said, one of the goals is to learn about the E3 model. It's an economy-wide multi-sector model of the U.S. economy. Professor Larry Golder built this well over 20 years ago. I've personally been working on the model for 11 years. And we like to think it's a pretty good model, but we fully admit that all models have strengths and weaknesses and that there's no such thing as one model to rule them all. So if you really want to be interested in the model and talk about some of and learn more about it, we have our book, Confronting the Climate Challenge, as Jerry mentioned, and we have a link here on our carbon pricing calculators. And so the model is has a particular emphasis on energy-related industries and the tax system. So it allows for the interactions of environmental policy and taxes on capital and labor, and we pay particular attention to capital dynamics, which helps us think about how the impacts change over time. The data that generates the results that are on the calculator today is from data from 2013. I realize that that was a long time ago, in a time where we had much different oil prices and other things. And so we're actually working now on updating our data to the most recent data available. And at that point, we'll be able to update our numbers. So this is, I just want to also emphasize that this calculator is something that we plan on updating as we make improvements to our data or our model. This is not like a standalone one-time shot. So please visit as you can, and we'll do our best to keep updating it, and we'll have notes on the page about when changes have been made. So you'll be able to see if there's an update that you've missed. Kind of going through here, we have a launch event that you can certainly watch. And we have a nice Q&A with Suzanne Brooks from Environmental Defense Fund, Joseph Mikett from the Niskanen Center, and Adele Morris from Brookings, kind of discussing not just the calculator, but the different policy proposals from this year. Because as we know, besides the Energy Innovation and Dividend Act, we've seen 7 other carbon pricing bills introduced this year, and we discussed them. I just wanted to throw out some caveats here about what we actually can and can't model as we go through this. So we are modeling we're modeling a tax on energy-related carbon dioxide emissions. So we're not able to model taxes on non-energy-related carbon dioxide emissions, so process emissions, so like the emissions that are created from the production of cement. And we don't look at taxes or impacts on other GHG emissions at this time. And we also, importantly, we don't include border adjustments, except for gasoline, really. So I know a lot of the policies that have been proposed this year do include some sort of border adjustments. Unfortunately, or fortunately, the way those bills are written is that the border adjustments are pretty much left to be determined by the administration at a later date. And so there's not like details there. So it's really hard to say that we're actually, if we put a border adjustment, we're actually modeling the exact border adjustment of that policy. And so we just don't include border adjustments, and you should certainly consider that when you look at the impacts, especially on GDP. And then finally, I want to just talk about two things I think this is a pretty good model, but these are projections, not forecasts. I do think that those are two different things. Sometimes they get conflated, as I joked during our carbon pricing event where I introduced the calculator, you don't get your money back if these projections are wrong. They depend on a great number of values whose values are uncertain. We use models as laboratories. And so during that laboratory, we have a non-policy evaluation and a policy evaluation. So really what we're doing is we're comparing holding fixed all these other things, what we think is going to happen. And any kind of single assumption could change the results. We do our best to keep up with baseline forecasts and new estimates of price elasticities. And we're always kind of trying to improve our model as well, as I said. But we think there is a lot of sensitivity here. And so as you utilize this carbon pricing calculator to talk about the Energy Innovation and Dividend Act or any of these other policies, just keep in mind that these are projections. They're not, you shouldn't like take them as this is the answer. But I think what's really nice about it though is that we're evaluating the same policies using the same model and using the same assumptions. So it's a good comparison exercise. So it's a good way to compare results. And think about, I put more value in the comparison of different policies than I would into the actual value of the projected emissions for, say, one policy. Also at RFF, we're certainly happy for everyone to share our work and to use use our resources. You can copy and redistribute our material. We actually provide, I'll show you data that you can actually download into a data file that you can put on your computer so you can actually see the numbers yourselves, create your own, you can use those to create your own table if you'd like. But we do ask that you always give us credit as the source of the data that you're using. And so we have some rules here on sharing our work. And certainly don't use it for commercial purposes. But as your organization, I don't think that's a problem. Okay, so why don't I go back up here and show you how to use the calculator. So the first thing about the calculator is that we have a lot of different measurements. And so if you scroll over this kind of eye icon, it will kind of describe what measurements you can choose. Or you can just click this box and you can choose the different measurements. So in our first kind of 1.0 carbon pricing calculator, the measurements that we're introducing now are annual emissions, annual revenues, the carbon price, which is a useful comparison, cumulative emissions, the consumer prices is actually the percent change in consumer prices in 2030. So that's not consumer prices over, that's what that means. We have gross domestic product and distribution of impacts. And so I'm going to run through all these, but first I want to show you what you can policies you can actually include. And so we have two different parts of the data series that you can include here. And so the first one is a custom carbon pricing design. So you can, through the box here, you can choose an initial tax per metric ton starting from $10 all the way to $70. This is going to be a policy that's implemented in 2020. And then you can choose your tax growth rate. So right now, besides the Deutsch bill and the Coons bills, all the other policies we restrict to a percent change, annual percent change above inflation. We are going to work on adding a discrete choice, like a discrete jump, as in the Deutsch and the Coons-Feinstein Act, but we haven't done that yet. And then the revenue recycling here, we only consider revenue neutral policies here. So we have the per household dividend, as in the energy innovation and carbon dividend. We also include payroll tax cuts, individual income tax cuts, and corporate income tax cuts. So these are the custom policies. And then this is very similar to what we had before on our carbon pricing calculator or carbon tax calculator we had before. And one of the new innovations we have here is that we've modeled all to the best of our ability, because there's details that we can't capture in every single policy, but to the best of our ability, we've modeled these different, all the eight bills that have been introduced in 2018. And so the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, American Opportunity Carbon Fee Act, et cetera, et cetera. And so you can kind of click on these, choose them, and compare, and they'll be graphed here. So why don't I just stick with the Energy Innovation and Carbon and Dividend Act for now versus business as usual. And so if we go up here to the graph, so you choose annual emission. So let's start with carbon price, because that's maybe the simplest thing. And so what it first does is just graphs the carbon tax over time. And so the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, as you know, starts at $15 and rises $10 a year. And so this shows that, whereas the Coons bill actually goes a bit further, starts at $15 a year and rises at $15 a year. I heard Senator Coons, who is a co-sponsor of the bill last year with Senator Flake, said that if he couldn't find any Republican co-sponsors, he was going to do a Democratic version of the bill. And so part of that Democratic version was to have a steeper price increase. And then, so you can also scroll over each year and it'll tell you Climate Action Rebate Act or the Energy Innovation Act. It'll tell you the price in any given year. So you can scroll over that as well. And then if we go over to these toggles at the top right, we can toggle to table view or chart view. And then you can also click here to download the information to your computer. So I think that'll be, could be very useful. And so we can click on, say, the Rooney Act, which is much different, which starts at $30 in 2021, which is $29.41 if we convert that, adjust for inflation, to 2020. So we have a correct comparison, and that rises at 5% a year over time. Graphically, the policy here starts in 2021 and then rises at a much slower rate. So that's a carbon price. And so I think that the biggest thing that people really want to know is, like, what are these policies actually going to accomplish in terms of the main goal of reducing emissions? So that's what we have here. And so let's just concentrate again on the Energy Innovation Act. And so what we see here is that the gray line here is business as usual. We get this business as usual projection from the Energy Information Administration's annual energy outlook. We didn't produce this business as usual. We're taking that as given from this other analysis. And then what we're doing is what we're doing in our modeling is we're computing the change from business as usual and then applying that to this business as usual to get our estimate of what emissions would be under each policy. And so again here, you know, given that it's $15, we don't anticipate model does not anticipate a very large reduction in the first year, but much larger reductions as we go over time. And so if we compare that to some of these other policies, so like the Market Choice Act, which starts in 2021 at $30 or $35, excuse me, we see that we maybe do expect a pretty decent reduction in the first year of that policy. In 2021, the policy is introduced and we think that this emissions would fall a lot more in the first year than it would under the Market Choice Act, and that's just due to a very different initial price path. But then over time, you can see these results diverging where we anticipate more reductions from the Energy Innovation Act due to the fact that there's a higher price. We used to have in this little box here that comes up with the mouse, we used to show how that the value is relative to 2005. I've asked our developers to add this, but it has not occurred yet. So in case you guys are all just interested, there was about 6 billion metric tons of energy-related CO2 emissions in 2005. So that's the six number up here. And so 3 billion metric tons is about a 50% reduction relative to 2005. And so what this model is projecting is that in 2028, emissions will be less than 50% of energy-related CO2 emissions will be less than 50% of 2005 levels. Again, we have all these other metrics as well. So we have revenues, which obviously is very interesting. Policymakers are especially interested in this. Carbon pricing raises a lot of revenues. And even though emissions are falling, we anticipate that actually revenues are increasing for all of these most of these policies, but for all these other carbon tax policies that we actually, even though the policies are reducing emissions, because the price is increasing on an annual basis every year, we actually anticipate at least through 2035 that emissions will be rising. And that's one thing you hear from people who may oppose carbon price, and they say, well, if you're gonna use it as a revenue, why would you use it as a revenue source? Because revenues are, you're just going to send revenues to zero. But with the price increasing over time, we actually don't see that at least till 2035. Maybe in the longer run, we'll see that, but we don't see that in the shorter run. So cumulative emissions, I think, is interesting from the true the impacts of what the climate really. It's not a one-year snapshot of what emissions are. The climate damages depend on how cumulative changes happen over time. And we can see how those change quite drastically. And so we see quite a huge reduction, some 20, almost 30 billion metric tons of energy-related CO2 emissions will not be in the atmosphere in 2035 that would have been otherwise. under this policy. So moving on, the model, the calculator currently displays the percent change in consumer prices in the year 2030 relative to baseline. So this is not the change in consumer prices relative today. This is the change in prices from if we're in 2030 and we had a price or we didn't have a price. And so we've concentrated on energy-related policies here, energy-related goods. So air transportation, electricity, fuel, oil, motor fuels, and natural gas. In 2030, the price of the Energy Innovation Act is relatively high due to that high growth point, growth rate. And so you actually maybe see higher increases in the prices than you would for a policy that had a lower carbon price. So there are, you know, the whole point of a carbon tax is to change relative prices, and those will be reflected in consumer prices. So I'm actually going to move, I'm going to skip past GDP for a second. I'm going to go to distribution of impacts. So people like to talk about that a carbon price raises prices and therefore it's going to make the lowest income households worse off. But there's a lot of evidence that that's actually not the case, especially in that result especially depends on what you use with the revenues. So what you use with the, how you use the revenues is actually really important for what the overall kind of distribution of impacts is going to be. And dividend policies tend to be a relatively progressive use of the revenues. And so what we're seeing here is that three income quintiles, we're estimating that the three income quintiles are better off than they would have been otherwise in the first year of the policy. And so I want to just be clear here about what the distribution of impacts are here. And I've gotten a couple questions about this, is that the distribution of impacts here are measured using a separate RFF model, this RFF incidence model. And what this model does is it takes price and income changes from the Goulder-Halstead E3 model, and it inputs into this model that has a lot of detail on spending and income sources by household. And what it produces here is the change in economic welfare for a household in just the first year of the policy. And so one thing to think about, especially related to the Energy Innovation Act, is that the price impacts and the income impacts, which affect these change in welfare per household, depend on the trajectory of the price over time. And so if you have a Energy Innovation Act, which has only a $15 price in the short run, but has a $150 price, $160 price in 10 years, that's going to factor into the impacts in the first. And those are going to tend to kind of make the policy look a little worse than it would otherwise. And the other thing here is that because this is only a year one policy, we only have 1 year of revenues to refund here. And so in the first year of the policy of the Energy Innovation Act, we don't have a lot of revenues to rebate. So that's why this policy, and I've got some questions about this, may not look slightly different than, say, the American Opportunity Carbon Fee Act. And so the American Opportunity Carbon Fee Act has a much higher carbon price in the first year, but has a slower rate of growth. And so those two kind of things offset each other in terms of the impacts in the absence of the rebates. But because this is only a year one analysis, in year one, there's a lot more rebates to go around under the American Opportunity Carbon Fee Act than there is the Energy Innovation Act. So that's why you get these different results. And so I just want to be clarifying here where these are coming from. And I would also mention that we're definitely working hard on updating our distributional model to think more about the impacts over time. So as I said, the use of the revenue is a really important determinant of the distribution of impacts. Constant dividends, where you get equal dividends to each household, you know, $1,000 means a lot to a low-income household. The lowest income quintile are households that make on average about $15,000 a year. So that is significant. I remember first year after college, I probably made about that much money. If someone gave me $1,000, I was the richest man in the world. Now it would mean a lot, but it would mean a lot less. So it's all relative. So you know, the rebates just make are just much higher proportion of the fraction of income for these households. And so then our last impact is going to be on GDP. So the GDP impacts here, we start in 2020 and go forward under business as usual and under each bill. I would say that if we actually, I got to make a couple points about the GDP impacts, is we do show that policies, even if you have corporate tax income rebates, we actually never find a policy that increases GDP relative to business as usual. So the model we use always is going to lower GDP as a result of a carbon pricing policy. So we don't find a double dividend. So let's just be upfront about that right now. I know that there's some other studies out there that might find something different. That's okay, certainly. We can have disagreements and discuss how what assumptions lead to this. What I would say though is that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's like there's costs and benefits. And so this is a GDP impact holding fixed any improvements to the economy caused by reducing emissions. So this is kind of a very conservative estimate of GDP. And so it's not showing is if implementing a carbon price reduces local co-pollutants, which is going to reduce asthma, reduce sick days, that might increase GDP because we're going to have more people working and be more productive. So that could increase GDP relative to the policy line. And it's going to debate whether or not we're going to get that above or below the green line or the gray line, so to speak. And so this is like our conservative estimate of if we ignore the positive impacts of a policy on GDP, what are the impacts going to be? So this is, I just want to be very upfront that this is not including those interactions, and we can call this a kind of a conservative estimate. I'd also say that if we actually started this this graph from zero billion to 22 to 30 billion, you actually probably wouldn't see the difference in the two lines. And so relative to the change in emissions, the change in GDP is relatively small. Even for a policy such as the Energy Innovation Act, we see that these impacts are not huge. And so KMP here, so in business as usual, we have 2030, about $27 billion of GDP. Well, if we go to the next year under the Energy Innovation Act, it's $27 billion. On an annualized basis, these changes are actually really small changes in annual growth. And so I think one of the key takeaways is relative to the gains that you get from your emissions reductions are falling by, 50% or more. GDP is you're delaying your arrival to a GDP threshold by 6 months to a year.
Mark, an overarching point that we make to our volunteers. I love how easy this calculator makes it to show the trade-offs of the different policies. And they're all good. They're all going to be great for the environment. And a difference between the Deutsch policy, ours, and some of the others is, Coons aside, you're going to get stronger emission reductions. As a result, you're going to get stronger climate benefits and stronger health benefits. It's also more fair. It is more progressive than the other policies. And what you give up in return is a little bit less GDP growth. Can you comment on that fundamental trade-off for a carbon fee and dividend type policy like Deutsch versus the others?
This goes to something that's in, I keep saying this in the book. Sorry for keeping repeating this. All the policies that we look at generate benefits, and then there's costs. So like one cost is lower GDP. Another cost could be the measure of economic welfare the overall measure of economic welfare. And so that's something that we don't have here, but it's a big focus in our book. The reason we don't have it here is that it's the measure of welfare we have is a kind of a, using a technical term, is intertemporal. So it kind of takes into account the effects over all the years into a kind of a one number. And it's kind of difficult to think about what the welfare costs are on an annual basis. And so we're working on kind of figuring out how we're going to put those costs into an annual so we can kind of make a nice clean comparison with the benefits. But these policies are all going to generate benefits that exceed the costs. And so, you know, I think that thinking about the double dividend of higher GDP is the wrong way to think about climate policy. It's all policies are going to have costs, and those costs aren't always going to be distributed evenly. And so one of the nice things about a dividend approach, not necessarily the Deutsche bill, but just dividends generally, is that you're using the revenue to kind of offset what could be unfair to certain groups of the population. And so you can use the revenues to offset kind of how the costs are distributed, but you still have costs, but you have benefits. And so one thing we talked about in the book a lot is that not only the benefits of reduced emissions, and so you could take a social cost of carbon and multiply it by these emissions reductions that we have here and generate a very large kind of annual climate benefit, but we also show these policies generate really large health benefits in terms of reduced local air pollution, especially PM2.5. So I like to think about that, you know, I think the win-win-win narrative, it's maybe not necessary. I mean, maybe that's the politics. I don't know. I'm not a politician. I'm an economist. I think it's just fair to say that, look, the benefits of this policy far outweigh the costs. So yeah, you're giving up a little GDP, a little consumer welfare overall, but you're generating quite a lot of benefits in not just kind of global benefits in terms of reduced emissions, but also local benefits in terms of these health benefits.
Thanks for that. And we will be discussing that point and actually showing the page from your book at our November conference. So stay tuned, more to come on that front. I want to thank you for, one, doing this work that I know will help further efforts generally to get a strong carbon price passed in the U.S., and for taking the time to come on to the program tonight. We benefit greatly from your expertise.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, we've put a link to Jerry's email in the chat, as well as a link to the forums where we can continue the discussion. I know we could jump in a lot more with questions that have been provoked by your really thoughtful and in-depth explanation tonight, Mark. So we really, echoing Jerry's words, just want to end by thanking you for your time, for really walking us through and helping us be more empowered and informed advocates. So,
Thank you so much. Great talk, Mark.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.